Modern migration and globalization issues are forcing museums around the world to think about their role in society. For example, how open are museums really? Can they balance the pressures of nationalism and multiculturalism? What kinds of citizens are they trying to create? These are questions asked by our guest, Professor Peggy Levitt, in her recently published book, Artifacts and Allegiances: How Museums Put the Nation and the World on Display. She joins us to discuss one of the biggest and most thorny issues in the museum world, diversification. I'm Temi Odumosu. This is Medea Vox. Welcome, Peggy Levitt.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I will pick your brain about your experiences traveling around the world to some of the most prestigious museums. But before, I wanted to go back to some beginnings. Why are museums an important subject to study?
Well, I began life as a migration scholar. I've spent a good 20 years of my career studying how people stay connected to their homelands at the same time that they become part of the places they move to. Whether I was studying people from Brazil or India or Pakistan or the Dominican Republic who had come to the Boston area and what kinds of ties they maintained back home, I always found that there was some kind of enduring economic or political or religious engagement. I began to ask myself, you know, how can we have this enduring understanding of this bounded nation state and yet people live aspects of their lives across borders, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes involuntarily? And where do we imagine the nation? And where would a different understanding of the nation come from? And that's really where museums come in, because they've been so central in both creating and imagining nations, and perhaps in creating new social imaginaries, new understandings of what the nation looks like and how it's constituted.
So your starting point is really the outside looking into the museum rather than the other way around.
Right. So trying to understand how museums might shape a different kind of understanding of the world, give us the cultural building blocks to have a different kind of conversation about a different kind of nation, and then the next step to create different kinds of social institutions and social safety nets that actually respond better to the reality of people's lives.
Most people's encounters with museums of varying kinds and also galleries are usually quite specific and often affective. There's a kind of memory that stays with them. What's your earliest museum memory?
Oh, good question. Well, my mother was a big, you know, culture buff. So she dragged me to museums as a child. I also was an only child, so we didn't go to amusement parks or to play miniature golf. I had to get with the adult program. So I do remember going often to the Museum of the City of New York, which had wonderful dollhouses, really wonderful dollhouses, and a big old-fashioned fire truck, and the Haydn Planetarium. And then the cloisters at a point, which is the medieval, it's like a cloister that was brought from Europe and is up in Fort Tryon Park, so away from the Metropolitan Museum, but as part of the Metropolitan Museum. And she was into aquamonoles at that point, which are these pictures that don't necessarily look like pictures. And, you know, learning about aquamonoles. So that's actually, the book is in her honor because she went in search of aquamonoles. So,
oh, those are those vessels that are shaped like birds and other animals.
And you
right?
don't realize they're
yes.
pictures, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
You and I work with museums regularly, but for a non-specialist listener, could you say a little bit about what museums were originally for, or how they were conceived and who their initial publics were?
So many of the world's prominent museums were born around the same time that the nation state where they're located were born. And so they were very much part of nation building projects. So, you know, to be a strong, unified nation, you had to have a museum. You put customs and artifacts and values on display that complete strangers could recognize, and then they could feel part of this imagined community. Often they were the royal collections. You know, here in Denmark, there's the paintings from Dutch Brazil in the 1600s that were so influential in shaping how Europe thought about the New World, that people were so excited by these paintings that when they were sent back to Europe or brought back to Europe by the Governor General, that they got into the curiosity cabinet of the Danish king. And that's how they ended up in the Danish National Museum. So also this idea of a curiosity cabinet that people would collect and kind of control, create worlds and control them. And then, of course, there's a hierarchy. There's power relations displayed in those worlds. And so which objects are put on display more prominently? How are others put in relation to them? How does the light direct your gaze? And so they reflect hierarchies of knowledge. And first of all, they reflect a kind of understanding of a certain kind of knowledge as legitimate, objective, true. And also that the country that had these objects to put on display, there was a kind of evolutionary sequencing that was implicit. So we have cups and them from over there, they have cups too, but ours are better, you know. And so visitors were being very much socialized into this kind of Western-centric, superior understanding of Europe as the sort of pinnacle of civilization.
The curiosity cabinet is a really interesting sort of metaphor for even thinking about how contemporary museums encourage people to find something interesting in their spaces, because it's that it's a balance between taxonomy and kind of ordering the world, and at the same time just encouraging wonder about all those magical things out there which maybe most people haven't seen. Do you think we're still in that curiosity cabinet space when the way museums work right now?
Well, I mean, when you think about just the bricks and mortar of museums, it's hard to get away from that. So when you ascend the staircase to the Metropolitan Museum or many of the world's great museums, you're sort of ascending into this temple of knowledge and you go into this grand entrance hall. So the blueprint has these kinds of values embedded in it. And it's interesting, I don't know if you visited the Immigration Museum in Paris. It's kind of on the outskirts of Paris at one of the old gates, and it's in this old colonial building. And so in the, you know, sort of etched in the outside facade are these incredible homages to colonialism. And then you go inside and it's a museum about immigration in France. So it's a big kind of clash of civilization or clash of consciousness in a way.
And that conflict that you are describing is something that now museums are grappling with again because of this buzzword of migration and, you know, how are we going to accommodate, respond, reflect these changing notions of the nation, but also just the intercultural dynamics of having people speaking different languages and having different cultural customs right in our space. How would you describe the energy in certain museums at the moment around this buzzword of migration?
Well, I think that museums around the world are kind of realizing that something needs to change. When you look at statistics, whether it's in, you know, Europe, the United States, the Gulf, who comes to museums, who's on the inside of museums doesn't look enough like who's on the outside of museums. And so in order to survive and thrive into the 21st century, museums really have to do something differently. And a lot of that depends upon the funding. So in Europe, in the Gulf, museums are used as tools by the government to achieve certain kinds of goals. So that means you're beholden to a certain kind of master. If you're a private museum, which most of the museums are in the United States, then you have different kinds of masters and different kinds of parameters that bound what you're going to do. But still, I think that there's a lot of discussion about sort of the need to diversify not just visitors, but also curators and directors and how to do that, how to do that in this neoliberal age where, you know, the humanities as disciplines is really suffering. How are you going to get some first-generation college student to study art history when their parents are saying to them, no, you need to be a doctor, you need to be a lawyer, something secure, you know, something straightforward.
Your book features case studies from different places. So you've got Stockholm, Copenhagen, Boston, New York, Singapore, Doha in Qatar. You describe them as having different kinds of cultural armature. I think that's the word you use. Why did you choose to take this kind of stark comparative approach?
Well, the book, in addition to being about museums and migration and nationalism and cosmopolitanism, it's also a plea to have a more open mind about how we study globalization. So if one model is to study one place very deeply and over time, that's really important. And it's really important to have people who are sort of experts in that kind of analysis. But another agenda of the book was to say, we also need people who can know enough about several different places to see kind of the comparisons between them. And that isn't the same kind of scholarship, but that kind of scholarship is complementary to the kind of traditional, deep, narrow scholarship. And we need both, but they need to be judged on their own terms. So that was my idea of going comparatively. And then also, one of the overarching questions of the book is to look at the role of museums in nation building and world positioning. In other words, not just how does the museum help people imagine the nation, but the nation's position in the world. Then I had these kind of neat little pairs of Sweden and Denmark, who are sort of over empire, if you will. I think Sweden still sort of sees itself more of a world player as Denmark does, and we can talk about why. And then the United States, with which, depending upon where you are, some people, Donald Trump would tell you, you know, we're still at the height of our empire and we'll stay there. And other people would recognize it's over, you know, it's on its way down. And then you've got Singapore and Doha, who are really using cultural institutions to claim a more prominent regional, if not global, role.
And you mentioned the subtle, or perhaps very strong, differences between Denmark and Sweden, culturally speaking. Could you say a bit more about what you've noticed in terms of those differences in this region?
I actually don't think that Sweden and Denmark are as different as people would want to make them out. Even in the time that I was writing the book, there were major shifts in xenophobia and restrictiveness in both countries, and then more openness. It was almost like I had to keep rewriting the chapter, because every time I turned around, there were policy shifts. And, you know, the book is outdated now, in a sense. It's a snapshot of a particular moment, because things have really change. I just, being in Copenhagen, everyone was talking about budget cuts because of the change in government. And, you know, when you have a change in government in this part of the world, it really has significant implications. So I think there's more, in a sense, there's a difference in the performance. So the social welfare systems look like they're tougher in Denmark than in Sweden, but it's more performance, or the political correctness ethos, you know, that what do we say? So Danes kind of say Swedes are too politically correct. They never talk about anything important. And Swedes say, oh, this, the Danes, they're so rude. And how could they talk like that? But it's the actual difference in sort of what's being discussed is not as big as the, I think, the performance of it. And that also has to do with always being compared to each other, right? But getting back to your question about cultural armature, one of the arguments I'm trying to make is that part of what explains where museums fall on this cosmopolitan nationalism continuum, in other words, how they display the nation in relation to the world, has to do with the kind of deep cultural structures of a city and a nation. And the modern Danish democracy kind of was born at the same time that Denmark lost a lot of its territory, lost a lot of its German-speaking population. So in a lot of people's minds, a strong Danish democracy depends upon a homogeneous population. and also is about, I forget the expression, about we're going to heal our losses by looking inward. It's a famous, you probably know it, and I can't remember it off the top of my head. I think Grundtvig said it. And so if you associate your strength and your trajectory as a nation as small, inward, homogeneous, then that's deep. Those roots go deep. And so it's very hard to reconsider that and have a discussion about what do we actually look like today. And I think that Sweden had always seen itself as sort of this moral exemplar, and solidarity doesn't stop at national borders was Olof Palme's bandwagon. And so Sweden was more open to the world. But also, I think that's a rejection of nationalism. So if you're global, then you don't have to look at episodes in your history that are some things you don't want to talk about, like, you know, helping the Nazis or eugenics experiments or how you've dealt with the Sami. So it's both an embrace of the global and a moral imperative, moral responsibility, but also a rejection of the national.
In fact, what you describe is making me think about how museums and archives and libraries have responded to my presence as a researcher trying to probe colonialism in this environment, and the kind of uncomfortableness and the all of the tensions that surrounded just accessing archival material. I mean, forget the wider cultural dialogue. In some respects, it's kind of protecting, you know, that veneer of things being sort of maintaining a continuum, because to probe a past that is unresolved is like to disrupt what people have been trying to maintain for some time. So it's a really interesting way of thinking about the research process, actually.
So that's interesting that you say that, because in Qatar, anywhere between 12 and 16 museums were on the docket when I was doing my research. And I think that's been cut back quite a lot. But one of them was a slavery museum. And that was because there were many slaves that then became part of Qatari families. And the thinking on the part of Sheikha Mayasa and her mother, who were kind of the heads of the cultural sector, was that you have to heal this now. You know, if you have a badly set broken bone, you've got to break it again and reset it. And that was very forward thinking. And part of it was about looking at how European and US museums were sort of trying to play catch up in that area and fend that off. Now, I can't tell you whether it ever got built or what it's like, but I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yes, I like the idea of kind of breaking the bone again in order to sort of rebalance and recalibrate. It's important, and there's a resistance to that, I think, in Scandinavia, which definitely needs to be addressed. There was a moment in your when you were discussing the Ethnographic Museum in mm-hmm. Stockholm, mm-hmm. and they've built a particular narrative around thinking about the global, but through the prism of collecting, you know, like what Swedish people went out and then brought back, and how is the world brought home. But you ask what I consider to be a very poignant question. You say, is it possible to explore the world without controlling it? And that kind of gets to the kind of essence, not just of the institutional values and what they're trying to achieve in the museum project, but also for the audience as well, coming to a museum expecting to get a particular narrative in a way because of media, because of their own ideas about what a museum is. We can't speak for individuals, but are there examples of museums or cultural institutions that you feel have kind of gone against this desire to control or to know definitively?
Well, you can ask that question on many different levels. So one is, are there creative ways that you can share materials? Anywhere from giving back materials, but also if we're not going to give them back, then could we care for them? Could the stewardship be collective? And how can you actually involve the community that, or the descendants of the community that created those materials in their presentation, in their interpretation? I think all over Europe in particular, there's a big soul searching about this and sort of, can we tell stories for the people whose voices have never been heard? How could we do that? Or should we opt out of that because it's impossible and then treat the objects as art? So that's what the Danish National Museum did. Instead of having all these different examples of pots and tools and clothing, they chose the most aesthetically beautiful and then sidestepped the issue of discussing who made these and under what conditions and et cetera. And that's a kind of discussion I see repeated all over the world. Then another move that's being made is to try to make the curatorial voice more transparent. So to try to say to visitors, look, there's a person who wrote these words, and, you know, it's not written in stone. These are opinions. And so you see things like a picture of the curator and a kind of personal statement that says, I got interested in this when I did this, and, you know, demystify it. And that's a very simple thing to do. In the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, they have these behind-the-scene galleries where you can go and listen to kind of videos about how this very influential couple collected and what was their vision, or why the museum doesn't have a lot of Native American materials. That's also a kind of response to understanding that the public wanted to know more about how these decisions are made. Now, the behind-the-scene galleries are really behind the scenes, so you have to sort of look for them and be motivated to find them. And then I'll just mention one last example that's from the Stockholm Museum, which is, what do you do with materials that aren't supposed to be seen by people that are not from that community? So they had some, I think they were First Nation materials from Canada, and they were trying to decide, first of all, what do we call this? Can we still use American Indian? And they decided they could, because the Smithsonian in Washington did. But then they thought, this object is not supposed to be seen by people outside of this community. What should we do? And they happened to have some First Nation visitors. And so they asked them, and they said, the First Nation visitors said, put a curtain and put a little text that says, these are materials that aren't supposed to be seen by people, outsiders. You decide. And so the visitor makes the choice. So there are a lot of creative examples of that. But you always wonder, since museums are kind of like peeling back layers of the onion, so you go in, you can just respond to the materials, the pure objects, and then you can read the text, and then you can listen to the audio guide, then you can do augmented reality. But how many people actually do that? So if the punchline is in the exhibition catalog that costs $80, how many people actually look at that, even if it's sprinkled on a table at the end of the exhibit? That's a big question, right? So I don't know what you're a museum professional in this context, in Swedish, Danish context. So how do you see museums preparing people, socializing them to be more informed visitors?
I mean, I'm a researcher, which I have to kind of put that on the line, because actually I see quite a lot of flaws. So I'm glad I don't have to speak from an institutional perspective. Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about the basic idea of how museums welcome people. And that welcoming, some things you can control. So you can have a very friendly info staff or the guard or the people in the shop or a very open architectural setting. And then there are things that have been inherited. So historical museums, they have these massive imposing facades. There's nothing you can do about the kind of power and majesty that's encoded in such architecture.
Right.
But that's a welcoming. But then also to think about how do, for example, children from various backgrounds, if I think about Denmark, which, you know, there's people from coming from so many different backgrounds. You have transnational adoptees, you have people who are immigrants or asylum seekers or undocumented, you have individuals who came just for a better life, economic migrants, I think they call them now. There are so many ways in which people have entered Denmark, perhaps quietly, rather than with a loud noise, mm-hmm. and they don't see themselves reflected or even a kind of balanced story of where they might fit in a narrative continuum across the course of history. And so why would they come to a museum is one of my questions. Like, what would encourage them to look at
For example, the portrait of the Congolese ambassador in the 17th century galleries in the Statens Museum for Kunst in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. It's there. It tells a story of global dynamics across Europe. It also says something about collecting because it's here and not in Holland. Right. But without that kind of interpretation, right, without that kind of willingness by the institution to sort of call people in to a potential artifact that they can connect with, then it just sits there in a room at the back somewhere if you happen to stumble upon it.
Right.
So welcomings can be about outreach. They can also be about just how museums decide to talk about their collection, the emphases that they give, what kind of paintings or documents or prints that they show in their advertising on the subway and, you know, the metro and all these different things. But I have had an interesting, positive experience at the Historiska Museum in Stockholm, I think it's called. I mean, I did spend some time there, and of course I was going as a researcher, but I was impressed at the way in which the lack of information about who we were 3,000 years ago was kind of laid bare. It wasn't like, okay, this is our story and we were this and we were that. It was like, well, you know, there's these bones and a bit of fragments of architectural material, but we don't know, but we're going to give you a sense, right, you know, right, of what the past was like. Right. But this is one way. Right. I found it very powerful.
Well, two things about that. First, that the treatment of those same materials in the Danish National Museum compared to the Swedish National Museum sort of epitomizes my argument in the sense that the prehistory materials in the Danish National Museum are used to tell a story. 14,000 years ago, we were Denmark, we traveled, we circulated, we traded, we're still great today. And the same materials in Sweden, 14,000 years ago, there was no such thing as Sweden, and it's all made up. And, you know, so it just speaks to that willingness. But one thing I'll say about the how you make people feel welcome, the book is also about sort of the globalization of the museum world and how different kinds of museums, based on what countries they're in, kind of contribute to that and are very influenced by that or operate very far from that orbit. And those that operate close are doing a lot of similar things, no matter where they are. And part of it is a set of strategies to become more welcoming, like these open houses on Friday nights that make the museum into kind of a community center or a big party place. And, you know, that kind of works to get people to feel like this is an institution that's part of their community. But it's amazing to see it replicated in Boston, in Brooklyn, in Doha. And then the family programming looks very similar. Or inviting artists, contemporary artists, to make some kind of work in conversation with something in the collection. That's another strategy that I saw replicated around the world. So, and then visitors' expectations of what a museum visit is. So, you know, the bookstore, the gourmet restaurant, the Blockbuster exhibit. It's a kind of package, and it travels. And because it is being both created but also disseminated by this traveling class of museum professionals and curators and directors, they kind of carry it with them. And every time they move, it's being spread and spread and spread. So does that contribute to more welcoming because we see the same familiar set of experiences, so we know what to expect?
Some of this is also connected. When we think about diversification, we're also thinking about who is managing a museum, directing it, the board of trustees, the whole rigmarole that goes into running a very large house. But at the same time, that does filter through to the feeling. If you come as, I mean, I would identify, I'm a person of African origin. My parents are from Nigeria. I co-sign to the politics of blackness and readily identify with it. So I'm always thinking about who is looking after my story. And are they recognizing that power, but also knowledge, is coming from different sources, that it can be shared, that it's not one way of seeing or perceiving the world? And so if you have a more diverse task force that's looking after a collection, you're more likely, I think, to get those perspectives that enable viewers or users, as we call them now, from different parts of the world to feel like, oh, they may not have much from the Andes here, but I'm from Brazil and I kind of feel that they're getting it a bit right, do you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's interesting because when you were talking in your book about the Albert Ickhout portraits,
yeah,
and how they're sort of individuals from Dutch Brazil,
right,
both indigenous and also African, and beautiful, very large paintings.
Right.
But they're just sort of on the wall, and they still are like that. Mm-hmm. No interpretation. So they're just this backdrop for our understanding of a strange colonial past that doesn't want to be talked about, right? But how might one then look after that historical story of those individuals that were part of this, you know, booming new world?
Well, there I think the diversity management regime is really important, because how a country talks about diversity, the categories that are used, the whether it's seen as an advantage or a disadvantage, a problem or an opportunity, something to remediate or something to celebrate, is really important here. Because in the U.S., the conversation now is about how undiverse museum professionals are and how undiverse museum audiences are and how we're heading towards being a majority-minority country. Something really needs to change. But that conversation is possible because we have a whole history of putting in place policies. Whether they work or not is another thing, so let's bracket that. But the fact that you can have policies that say, and then how long you keep them in place is another question. But, you know, policies to get more students of color into universities, or to, you know, get more faculty of color. So that's a kind of accepted strategy. I wonder what the parallel strategy would be. Would you be having a conversation in the Scandinavian context about this? And then what would the remedial action be? When I first started this project, I was so struck by how I assumed that, you know, labels, hyphenated labels, meaning saying I'm African Dane, or I'm not sure what your citizenship is now, but that I could say I'm, you know, Chinese American or Italian American or Indian American, and few people are going to question the American side of the equation because they're going to say that's what Americanness is. That label is seen as empowering. That's how you take your place at the multicultural table. That's why we can have institutions that are about the experiences of particular groups. In this context, that's seen as leading to social marginalization. That would be, you give somebody a label, you're excluding them. So it's like, how do you have the parallel conversation? What labels do you use? What is being done to make sure that there are more first-generation college students going to Malmö Högskola, you know? And so what would the affirmative action for the museum culture sector look like in this context that would be appropriate?
I have an idea. It's very simple. One thing I've noticed is that if you let go of the labels that you describe and you say, no, that's victimizing, then it means that that community becomes invisible. And that has happened to a number of communities. The way to make people present is to give them voice and enable them to speak on their own terms, to acknowledge how they choose to identify themselves, and not to say, no, but this is how I want to refer to you, but to give them space to speak their experience. But then also to recognize that they are viable and valid knowledge producers within the canon of knowledge production that museums are participating, as well as universities and other structures or centers of learning. I think the challenge certly in Scandinavia, well, I'll speak of Denmark because I spent a lot of time observing, is that there isn't that recognition that a voice from another community, wherever that may be, is a valid source of knowledge, equal, sometimes even better than the Danish voice. And that it seems very simple that people can speak their truths and it's recognized, but actually it doesn't happen.
Well, I mean, learning that the Danish word for equal means sameness, that's a very, very telling thing, because that means you can't be equal if you're different. And that's a very, very fundamental cultural armature, aspect of the cultural armature. It's about having to fit into a certain kind of box. And so breaking that open and breaking that habit and saying, maybe not, that's a big task. That's a really hard, big, big task.
And so breaking open and thinking about the other museums that you looked at outside of Scandinavia, we're done with them.
Okay.
What kind of lessons, positive ones, that maybe we can learn in a Western context, did you learn from your work in Singapore and in Qatar?
Qatar, it's hard to tell because only two museums were actually up and running, and the National Museum was, I think they're almost going to finish it now. That was a work in progress. So I could just see what they were planning in the YouTube video that they put up. The best museum I found, actually, or one of my favorites, was the Queen's Museum. That museum was able to do some very radical things because it was so off the beaten track. And it's a museum without a big collection. So it doesn't have an established role in the organizational distribution of labor. By that, I mean that, well, two things, that some museums are considered better for doing diversity than others. So the city museum is often delegated that role, and the National Museum does the nation. And so, and then also people come to those museums for certain reasons. So you can't stop being a bastion of New England colonial experience if that's what is expected of you and that's what your visitor base comes to pay for. There are constraints here. There are real institutional constraints. So this was a museum that's off the beaten track. You have to want to get there. It's not in Manhattan. It's in Queens. It's New York World's Fair building from 1939. Half of it used to be an ice skating rink. So the director, who is now the cultural commissioner of New York City, had this idea that museums should be like libraries. They should be resources. You know, so he hired community organizers. It's also located, I should say, in the most diverse borough of New York, right in the middle of a park, but that's surrounded by mostly Latin American and Asian immigrants. And so he hired these community organizers, and they kind of go out and do these activities, public art projects or video performances. And there's always something familiar, so people feel at home. They could recognize something, but there's always something, you know, pushing it. And then they say, oh, by the way, there's a museum down the road. So it's not even about getting people into the museum necessarily. It's sort of about creating community. And then realizing that there are all these people from Ecuador, they started doing these curatorial exchanges. So the woman who's in charge of public programming jokes that more people know the Queen's Museum in Ecuador than they know in Brooklyn. That's a very cool use of defining the museum almost like a community center, a place where they have ESL classes, they have art classes for kids with autism, and bring your performance of traditional Taiwanese dancing, your kids' recital here. And when you meet in the bathroom, it's like a kiss. And that's the first point of contact. That's a very different understanding about what museums could be. Now, let's be real. This museum can do that because it doesn't have a big private collection. It was far from the cultural center. It wasn't falling from such a high place. But if there are examples of more institutions that do this very creative, welcoming, definitely welcoming stuff, then you could see how the changes at the edges would contribute. There was a reinstallation recently of the Brooklyn Museum's American collection. And Holland Cotter, who's the New York Times critic of museums, said they're telling more of the kinds of stories that you and I are talking about, but they need to go farther. And saying there is a roster of museums in New York City, some are very specifically about race and ethnicity, and so they do that work. And then there are some that are like the Queens Museum or the Bronx Museum that are sort of on the edges. And then there's these encyclopedic museums, the Brooklyn Museum, the Metropolitan Museum, and the Met does nothing because it's in the kind of like global stratosphere. We don't need to get people in here because they just come to us. But there is a competition among these institutions for who's on the cutting edge. So you can get shamed into it, I think. You can be shamed.
That's a good approach, a strategy.
Well, you know, that's a last resort.
If all else fails, shame them into it. Last question. How would you like your book to be used? I mean, I know you said that it's a snapshot of a particular moment in time and things have changed. And particularly, I mean, you mentioned in Doha, more museums are now built since you did the research. But how still would you like your work to be used in a practical way?
Well, I'm a social scientist looking at a topic that mostly is studied by art historians or cultural studies people who don't actually talk with people about what they're doing and why they think they're doing it. I think it's a plea for the underutilized role that museums can play in helping create more successful, diverse societies. And museums not only can, but have to, because if they don't, they're not going to be viable and relevant in the 21st century. So I hope it jumpstarts that kind of conversation. I hope it jumpstarts that conversation across the globe. So it's not just a, you know, US conversation or a European conversation. I mean, I really hope to continue this research in the global South. But at the end of the day, it's also about canon changing. Because if museums are sites of global citizenship creation, and the whole book is about why do some museums do that and others don't, or to what extent do they do it, then the necessary follow-up question is, well, what do global citizens need to know? And until we make that more inclusive, and until we understand how canons are being formed and who's changing them and who gets included and what are the power dynamics behind that, that's another really important piece of this puzzle. So I hope that it leads to a discussion about that as well.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing your experience.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you.